You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, when did you last take a close look at things around your office, your workplace, like how inviting the reception area looks or how clean the break room is? Behavioral psychologists say little cues like these can say a lot about employee morale. We'll find out more.
First, earlier this week, Governor Walker announced $400,000 in new grants through the Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs that are targeted to helping veterans start and run their own businesses.
One nonprofit group, Bunker Labs Madison, received more than half of the funding that was announced. We invited their director and two of their entrepreneurs to join us. I talked first with Michael Ertmer from Bunker Labs. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having us and your interest in Bunker Labs.
Well, tell us, what are some of the obstacles to veterans, you know, coming out of the service and wanting to start their own business?
Sure. Thanks for the question. So there are 200,000 veterans that transition from active duty to the economy every year and will for the next several years. So one of the challenges a lot of them have, in fact, a few that you'll speak with today, but coming off active duty, like I'm a Wisconsin native. I actually had an ROTC scholarship, then was on active duty. But like a lot of people, you live in a lot of different places or you move away. And I was kind of the last person that thought I'd ever move back to Wisconsin. So I'm glad I did. But it's a another case of I was away from Wisconsin for 15 years before I moved back.
And so that network isn't going to be there.
Absolutely. So and even when people are deployed as guard or reservists and they deploy for 6 or 12 or 18 months, everybody's life kind of continues and business continues and their professional networks evolve and shift. And so even if they come back to the same position in the same city, your network has changed. So it's good to have or if you're moving back to a city you haven't lived in for several years or a state you haven't lived in for several years, it's important to have a professional network to plug back into to accelerate those connections.
A banker, a venture capitalist, looking at a resume, do they register veteran as a promising entrepreneur they want to support?
Excellent question, and there's no simple answer to that. So a lot of, I think the straight answer is veterans tend to hire more veterans and get it. There are kind of a lot of prevailing media narratives or perceptions out there about the military, specifically that we've come from a very hierarchical bureaucracy. And we're used to taking orders. Well, candidly, it's the opposite is more true than not, where more often than not, junior non-commissioned officers and officers are given assigned a mission, but they're not over-resourced to accomplish that mission. So in a lot of ways, they have to
think innovatively.
Exactly.
Interesting.
They have to do more with less. They have to solve the mission regardless of how little resources and people they might have to accomplish the mission. And if you look at the current generation of veterans who are deployed doing arguably, you know, economic development or, you know, country building, however you want to characterize those duties, they're trying to help foster economic activity and fight a war. It's like I can't imagine of anything more fundamentally entrepreneurial than taking on challenges like that.
So with all that in mind, what kind of things, what kind of services does Bunker Labs provide to help make that connection?
Sure. So the focus of what we do is to help military veterans start and grow their businesses. My background is, call myself recovering engineer, so recovering from the stereotype, but my whole background had always been product development and business development. So we focus on access to mentors, access to investment capital, and most importantly, getting that first paying customer. In my experience, capital follows good ideas and successful businesses. So regardless of what you need to do to get out there and get the minimum viable product in front of people and get it used, and the rest of it can be straightforward and following it. But even those vets that come back and start a company and have a great product idea and maybe have some sales, they may not be very experienced with raising capital beyond their friends and family. So that's something I have personal experience with. But more importantly, we've got a network of people that either do that for a living or can help coach them up very quickly. And the nature of being vets is we all have a very, you know, kind of unique shared experience where, you know, it's half a sibling rivalry of Army versus Navy versus Chair Force versus the Marines.
Air Force, I think you were saying.
Oh, sure. That too. Yeah, that's for Chris.
Okay.
Yeah, he'll like that joke. But yeah, regardless of what service they're in, there's kind of a unique shared experience and there's instant authenticity and credibility where regardless of what rank you were when you're in the military, that shared experience gets right to candor. There's, you know, it's kind of a unique relationship in business that's hard to replicate.
We'll meet a couple of participants in just a few minutes, but can you talk about the range of businesses people who've been through Bunker Labs have gotten involved in?
Sure. Well, we're still very much a startup helping startups. Mm-hmm. So nationally, we were founded in 2014 in Chicago. We're already in 14 cities. So Wisconsin, we've had the advantage of both the previous administration and certainly the Walker administration has been very eager and aggressive supporters of all things veterans and certainly veteran entrepreneurs. So dating back to some of the early programs that several of us were involved with was Techstars. So Techstars is one of the nationally better known brands of a startup accelerator. So they're a lot like Generator is kind of the Wisconsin version. Very similar model, very similar approach, kind of a 90-day charm school for startups. So with that as kind of the accelerator model, one of the national programs, almost 30% of the attendees in 2013 were from Wisconsin. And that was a result of support on both sides of the aisle, programs through Commerce and continued through in WDC, supporting veteran entrepreneurs. That's now kind of being accelerated with this Department of Veteran Affairs grant. But a lot of the support has been here in different piecemeal programs along the way.
And what does the state as a whole get out of supporting programs like this and training these veterans to become entrepreneurs?
So aside from the obvious opportunities, it's straightforward public policy, right? It's veterans and entrepreneurs, so it's very easy for elected officials to get behind. I think candidly for WDC and other economic development groups, it's an easier target or lever to pull than they have otherwise, because it's very challenging economic development on the economic development side to go out and just wave a magic wand and get more early stage and risk and investment capital, because entrepreneurs are at lots of different stages and there's no one place you can go to generally connect with them. It's kind of tribal by local regions or by cities. We actually have a network that now can, you know, it's fast, it's growing, it's national, it works between cities. But for Wisconsin, it helps connect these groups locally that otherwise wouldn't be connected.
Michael, thanks a lot for telling us about the program, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for your interest in Bunker Labs.
That's Michael Ertmer, Executive Director of Bunker Labs Madison. That's a nonprofit agency that supports veterans in their entrepreneurial efforts, and they're the largest recipient of newly announced grants through the Wisconsin Department of Veteran Affairs. We also talked to a couple of the veterans who are getting help as entrepreneurs from Bunker Labs. Brandon Shields spent 6.5 years in the Marine Corps, leaving the service as a captain. He's a second-year MBA student at UW-Madison. And we spoke with Air Force veteran Chris Johnson, commercial pilot, certified flight instructor with a PhD in industrial systems engineering from UW-Madison. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Brandon, thanks for coming up.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to hear about briefly about your military background, and then we'll get into the businesses that you are working to start up. Let's start with you, Chris.
Absolutely. I'm an Air Force veteran. I'll just go ahead and say that Mike likes to give me a hard time.
Not the chair for us.
Yeah, he says it's a lot like the military, but more like an airline. So I was enlisted for 5 years, and then I would transitioned to the National Guard while I pursued school for 6 years, went to school for way too long, and then ended up starting a company focused on aerospace technologies after finishing my PhD here at UW-Madison.
And then, Brandon, now your background.
So I did my undergrad education at Bates College in Lewiston, Maine, and after that I joined the United States Marine Corps, where I was active duty for 6.5 years. Combat deployment to Afghanistan as a police advisor, and when my son was born, it was time to get out and go back to school. So that's how I ended up at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where I'm pursuing an MBA focusing on marketing.
And then let's get into your businesses. Brandon, you're in an earlier stage, I understand it. What are you working toward?
Correct. So right now I'm in a concept stage, and I'm pursuing a couple classes at the university to really help me build my idea into a business. But the idea is that we pair students within the university who are interested in babysitting with parents, faculty, and staff in the university who need babysitters. So we leverage the network of being a badger to provide a trusting sort of service where parents can hire sitters at an affordable rate, and students have employment opportunities. Because, you know, as a single father, I'm laying in bed at night wondering who's going to watch my kid and how can I trust them. And that's where this idea came from.
And then what are you going to get out of working with Bunker Labs?
So Bunker Labs is really helping to provide additional mentorship and access to resources. I met Mike in 2015 when Bunker Labs was first launching in Wisconsin, and I wanted to form a way to really make student veterans and the entrepreneurship community, get together. So I wanted to pair my veterans at the student or my student veteran club at UW with Mike and his resources to really form that network.
And then, Chris, talk more about your business's pilot training.
Yeah, so I originally started my business in 2011 to commercialize some of the products of my research at the university here in Madison, which is now an FAA Center of Excellence for Research. And we developed software products for training, simulation, and compliance in the aerospace industry. And lately, I've been actually working in unmanned aerial systems, so working on a new application that manages everything in compliance for drones, training drone pilots, allowing them to plan flights and manage risk, and then the data management is a real big emerging problem that we're focused on, and plugging in data science and analytics technologies, so it's sort of an end-to-end platform. So that's a new product that we pitched to Bunker and we got into the program.
And then how are they gonna? How are you hoping they can help you make that a reality?
So they have great educational speakers on the days that we meet, mentorship, resources, and peer-to-peer networking is actually really strong. I actually met Mike many years ago, and what kind of led him down the road of veteran entrepreneurship, mentorship, and accelerators was that program he was talking about. He was the director, and I was a manager of that Patriot Boot Camp hosted by Techstars. And so he went down the pathway of Barker Labs, and here he is. And I continued growing my business into the drone industry, and it's been a great thing.
So let's talk about veterans as entrepreneurs. Brandon, what do you think about your background as a veteran that maybe gives you the skills to be a successful entrepreneur?
I think being in the military, you're not risk averse. You know, when you're used to having bullets flying by your head, then it makes it a little easier to jump into launching a new business because you're not as afraid of failure because the situations that you faced before were, you know, a bit more dramatic than losing a couple thousand dollars on trying an early stage business.
And Chris, for veterans out there who have been maybe thinking about taking the plunge, what would you say to them?
Well, I mean, just pursue something that you can eat, sleep, and breathe, and keep getting up when you fail, because perseverance is one of the number one traits that I would see among military entrepreneurs that makes them positioned for success.
And how about you, Brandon? Are people looking at your military background and thinking, yeah, this guy's going to be a good entrepreneur?
I think it has definitely helped me when it comes to connecting with people and finding people to support my business and my business ideas. But the way I see military veterans and entrepreneurship is that after World War II, people came home, used their GI Bill, got an education, or launched businesses. And I think there's an opportunity for this generation to do the same thing.
Well, good luck to both of you in your own business endeavors. Brandon, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Chris, thanks to you as well.
Thanks again for having me.
We were just talking to Chris Johnson and Brandon Shields. They're entrepreneurs getting support from Bunker Labs. Earlier we heard from Michael Ertmer from Bunker Labs Madison. You can learn more about the services they offer on the Central Time Facebook page.
Job interviews are designed for organizations to find the perfect candidate, but they're also a chance for applicants to figure out if this is a place that they'd like to work.
There's subtle and surprising clues at our workplaces, from the plants in the reception area to the dishes stacked in the break room. These nonverbal cues can speak volumes about a work climate.
Leah Fessler joins us now. She's a reporter and editorial fellow at Quartz Magazine. Leah, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Well, when did you first start thinking about these little things that might tell us more than we think they do about the places we work or the places we might want to work?
Yeah, for sure. So I think right now, you know, having a flashy, cool, kind of modern workspace is a really big thing. I'm 23 years old, and I think this is a really big draw for young people, especially when you're going on job interviews. So it's something that caught my eye kind of immediately when I began, you know, interviewing for full-time roles, especially at Quartz. We have a newly designed office, and you start to think, how does this represent the company culture? But a specific experience kind of that I speak about at the beginning of this piece that motivated me to look more deeply at these specific signs was noticing that there was a gallon of milk spilled in the refrigerator at Quartz, which is a communal refrigerator, and it was early in the morning, and you're kind of in one of these moral tests where you could walk away and nobody would see you and you wouldn't have to deal with sopping up the milk, or you could do the right thing. And I think oftentimes people do the right thing, but it's a matter of how they feel about doing that. So as I was cleaning up the milk, I was kind of evaluating. I had previously come from another job that I was very unsatisfied at and frequently not happy with, you know, the work and my environment necessarily. And so I thought, you know, would I have done this at my last job? And the answer was probably no. I probably would have, you know, notified somebody on the cleaning staff about the spill. But I realized, given both my satisfaction with Quartz and my feeling kind of more like an owner of the space, that I didn't, you know, obviously have a great time cleaning up the milk, but I was willing to do it. And that made me realize that there are signs, nonverbal physical signs within the office that really do evidence perhaps more strongly than what people might tell you on an interview what morale is like. Are people happy? Do they? I think this ownership mentality is really important. That signals engagement with your work and your colleagues. And I think I realized as I looked into this more that there were various physical signs of such ownership mentality.
Right. You talked to some behavioral experts and other experts about things to mm-hmm. look for, especially when you're there for a job interview and you can sort of decode some of these signals. And one kind of interesting one right at the top is if the hiring authority offers you a beverage, you should always take it and figure out who's going to actually be the one getting you the drink.
Yeah, this is fascinating. It says a lot about hierarchy. I think it's a big work trend right now to foster a more meritocratic and less hierarchical workplace. This is really great in terms of mobility and also communication styles. I think it's really appealing to a lot of people right now. And so when you think, how can I actually tell if this is a meritocratic workplace and more, is this just a respectful workplace? One really powerful piece of evidence about that, which Leanne Davey, one of the organizational psychologists I spoke with, mentioned, was seeing how support staff are treated. And this is one of the first things you can see, because generally when you walk into an office, you're immediately presented with a receptionist. And so, you know, usually you're sitting there waiting and someone, whether it's a hiring manager, someone else comes and says, can I get you, or are you interested in a coffee or tea or water? And so at that moment, you have the opportunity to say yes and not only get, hopefully get to go see what the kitchen looks like, which is a gold mine, but get to see, do they say, come on with me, or do they go get you the drink for you, which is like, as a person in authority, they're willing to do that. Or do they say to one of the members of the support staff or the receptionist, please go get Leah a drink or something? What that says is, it says a lot about the hierarchy and the communication style within the company, and whether they are willing to, you know, just help, everybody's willing to help it, help out, pitch in, take you to go get a drink. It's not like they necessarily need to follow the rules of a strict hierarchy and assign that lesser duty to someone else. And so that was an interesting sign, which also brings you to the kitchen. But it was also worth mentioning in terms of when you're first in the office, how people who are walking by treat the receptionist. Are they saying hi to him or her? Are they, you know, having a conversation with them as if, you know, they're just another teammate, or are they kind of ignoring them as if they were, you know, a piece of wall art that does things for them, which evidences a lot about the hierarchy and respect within the culture.
Right, and you mentioned the break room, which is another really fertile place to look for signs about how well it's cared for and what mm-hmm. sort of the signage is in the break room. Apparently that's mm-hmm. pretty common for there to be varying degrees of signs there. What should we look for to decode this?
Yeah, so, I mean, when it comes to the kitchen and the kitchen or kitchenette space within the break room, an obvious sign, if there's dishes everywhere and it's dirty, that's an obvious sign of, you know, lack of engagement or ownership. But what's a little bit more nuanced is the signage, particularly on the fridge. And so here what you want to look for is whether the signage is instructional or whether it's orienting. So if the signage on the fridge, like, for example, at Quartz here, we have two fridges. One says communal on it and one says personal. These signs are orienting. They're not telling me what to do or what not to do. They are just giving me information that allows me and infers trust in me to make an informed and respectful decision about my property and other people's property within the fridges. In contrast, a lot of fridges that you'll see will have signs sometimes aggressive, but often just more instructional, like, this is a personal fridge. Do not take other people's food. Or on when you open up the fridge, are there sticky notes on everybody's food saying, you know, Jennifer's, do not touch. When you have more instructional signs like this, what that tells you is that at some point in time, there was an issue in which people were not respecting one another's property and their food and their lunches. And so that's a sign that maybe there's a lower level of trust or respect between employees in that workplace, and that someone from a higher level or an authority had to kind of impose regulation as opposed to there kind of being a bottom-up.
And you talk about how communal workspaces, open space work plans, I should say, are really popular right now. You'll see a lot of those, but you should also look for private spaces, even among those open space work plans. How come?
Yeah, so what this comes down to is this idea of whether the workplace encourages you to bring your whole self as a person and not just a employer, not just someone that produces things for the company. So in our as a whole self, we have emotions, we have life realities that sometimes we do need to deal with privately, and sometimes whether it's, you know, you're having an emotional day and you need to just take a break and let those feelings out in a space where you're not going to feel judged, or maybe, you know, especially for mothers when it comes to breastfeeding, things like that, or maybe you just need to have a personal conversation with a colleague that's not something you feel comfortable despite the open and sharing environment that an open layout provides having in public. And so what by providing these private spaces, what this says is that a company not only respects your privacy but cares about you as a full person and cares that you feel comfortable like you would at home or in other spaces having those private moments without feeling as if you're going to be judged or evaluated poorly based off of them.
Leah, thank you so much for sharing all this today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was reporter Leah Fessler. She's currently an editorial fellow at Quartz Magazine.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, it's True Stories told live on the Moth Radio Hour. Among tonight's stories, a chaplain guides a family through death and goodbyes. A man wanders New York City during the blackout of 2003. And a daughter tries to break her father's silence about the Holocaust. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, yesterday, the northern Wisconsin community of Rothschild was the site of a series of shootings that left 4 people, including a police officer, dead.
The shooting stemmed from an incident of domestic violence that began at a local bank.
Rob Menser is with us now. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Rob, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, first, before we get to the details of the story, how are people reacting? How's the community doing? And this is affecting the whole Wausau area.
Absolutely. Yes, these shootings took place in the sort of south metro area of the Wausau area. There's several smaller suburban communities, but they're all clustered together. They're all contiguous with Wausau. And so this is certainly the worst single incident of mass shooting in this community's memory. The fact that it took place in 3 different locations, and the fact that it involved the death of a police officer is absolutely shattering.
And can you talk about what we know about what happened yesterday?
So police have now released the identity of all the victims. Police have not yet released the identity of the suspect. He is in custody, and they said at a 4 o'clock press conference, under intense medical care. It sounds like he may not be conscious. He is 45 years old, lived in Weston. He went into a bank called Marathon Savings Bank in the village of Rothschild and shot and killed 2 people there. This is characterized as a domestic violence incident, and at the 4 p.m. press conference, a representative for the State Department of Justice said that the victim of domestic violence has been identified, was not harmed. He went to Marathon Savings Bank apparently looking for her. He then traveled to a law office in nearby Schofield that we, our reporting has found was involved with his divorce proceedings, shot and killed an attorney there named Sarah Court San. Then returned to his apartment. We've confirmed it was his apartment in Weston, where he shot and killed Weiland, the police officer, and had a hours-long standoff with police, negotiations with police, exchanged fire, and was shot by policemen and then taken into custody.
And then as this developed, we had you had schools on lockdown in the area. Can you talk about how this, as this was going on, was affecting the Wausau area?
Well, it's a very, this apartment complex where he ended up has multiple buildings, multiple units. So he was apparently in his apartment, in an apartment, and police were speaking with him, negotiating with him, and at the exact same time, officers were escorting out families and residents of that building. They brought in bomb robots as a precaution. There did not turn out to be any bombs planted, but they didn't know what his plans were. So we have photographs of officers carrying small children across the lawn coming out of this apartment complex. You mentioned the schools in the D.C. Everest School District that has nearby schools there were locked down, as were a couple of healthcare facilities in Wausau in anticipation of potential mass casualties. There ended up being four victims and as well as the shooter. But at this time that it was going on, they were taking precautions to see what, it was not known how many victims there would end up being.
I understand from your reporting and your colleagues at the Wausau Daily Herald, there's trauma care, there's mental health care available, people coming in. What kind of things are out there?
That's correct. North Central Healthcare is a health facility here. My wife is an employee there, and they help to have counselors available in the D.C. Everest School District this morning. In addition, the school districts are trying to respond, and North Central Healthcare also has made a broader offer of making their crisis services known and other services that are available.
So, Rob, we've been seeing some details released last night, some today. What happens next? What don't we know? What are we looking ahead at?
Well, so police said that this was an isolated incident. This stemmed from this single shooter's domestic violence. And so in that sense, the man is in custody and the public is not in danger now. Their investigation continues, in interviewing witnesses and seeking more information about his motives. Wausau is going to be ready for a bunch of funerals now. The Marathon Savings Bank employees were Diane Look and Karen Barkley. I didn't say their names, and they were victims of this crime as well. And of course, Weiland will have an official funeral. And I think that the mourning in the community is going to have to proceed.
Rob, thanks for taking the time today.
Thank you.
That's Rob Mentzer, storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. He joined us to talk about the shootings that happened yesterday in Marathon County. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're continuing our conversation about yesterday's shootings in the northern Wisconsin town of Rothschild, which resulted in the deaths of four people. The shootings began with an act of domestic violence.
Domestic abuse is something that's often treated as something that, while serious, remains behind closed doors. But as we've seen in Marathon County, it can escalate and affect an entire community. Patty Seeger joins us now to talk about this. She's executive director of End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. Patty, thanks for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you for inviting me on.
So what was your reaction as you heard this news develop and heard that it was something stemming from an abusive partnership?
Well, it's sadly not always surprising when we work in this field. Last year alone, there were more than 60 domestic violence-related homicides in Wisconsin. That's more than one per week. We recognize the seriousness of these crimes, but whenever a homicide happens, and certainly one of this magnitude, you have no other feeling than absolute sadness and mourning for that community, for the law enforcement and the advocates who work in that community who deal with this issue day in and day out. It's unbelievably tragic. And the thing that's true about domestic violence homicides is that they are somewhat preventable.
Let's talk about that. How could we, as a society, as communities, prevent these domestic violence homicides?
Well, when domestic violence is occurring, there are a number of things, sort of markers that we look at. Leaving, separation is a big indicator that the situation might rise to fatal levels. Also, access to firearms. We know that in households where there are firearms, at least two-thirds of those households that contain a gun, an intimate partner in that house has had the firearm used against them, either in a threatening situation, threatening to shoot, or potentially kill. So what we know is domestic abusers are more likely to own guns than the general population.
So
getting guns out of the hands of domestic abusers is a really important prevention step.
Do we have laws? Do police, I guess, have the capacity to do that sort of thing?
Well, in Wisconsin and nationally, first of all, anyone who's convicted of any felony in Wisconsin is prohibited from having a gun. Any person who's convicted of a misdemeanor violent act of domestic abuse is prohibited from having a gun. Any person who is the respondent to a restraining order, a person who's subject to a restraining order, is prohibited, a domestic abuse restraining order, is prohibited from owning a gun. And then we have a big loophole. So if one of those people walks into a federally licensed gun dealership, they will run a background check and they will make sure that that person doesn't have a gun. But then there's a purchase of guns through newspapers, through online websites such as ArmsList, which is sort of the Craigslist for selling guns. And people can obtain guns, whether they are subject to some prohibition from owning a gun, because Wisconsin does not have universal background checks, which means that we do not check every gun purchaser at every potential point where a person could purchase a gun to ensure that they would be prohibited from owning a gun.
I wanted to ask about your advice for people, victims of domestic abuse, partner abuse, in a horrible situation. They would want to get out of the situation, but as you said, leaving is the point where it might escalate to the level of homicide. How does somebody deal with that?
Well, I think the most important thing for us all to understand about victims' choices to stay or to leave is that they know the situation better than any of us. So while the situation may be dangerous, some victims choose to stay because they recognize that it's actually safer for them to stay at least for that time. Many victims develop a strategy for leaving safely. And in order to do that, many victims connect with a local domestic violence program. There is one such program there in Wausau called the Women's Community. They offer services 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They're fully confidential. No one will ever know that that person calls there or goes there for counseling. But the staff and volunteers who work at that program are trained to help that person sort through the safety of staying or leaving and help them develop their own personal plan for safe departure.
I want to talk about law enforcement. I've sadly learned just in the last day that according to statistics and according to law enforcement officers themselves, domestic violence disputes are some of the most dangerous for officers responding. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, actually, a study done last year by the National Law Enforcement Officer Memorial Fund bore out that truth, that domestic violence is the single largest incident that police officers respond to in which they may potentially be killed. So it is obviously very serious. And again, I can't emphasize enough the presence of guns. If a domestic abuser has a knife, yes, he could kill somebody with it, but it's a lot harder to kill somebody with a knife than it is to kill somebody with a gun. And that easy access to guns and our understanding that domestic abusers are more likely to own guns than the general population, and when they own guns, they're more likely to use them either to threaten or potentially kill their partner, makes it all the more important for us to be hypervigilant in that regard. So police officers face a certain amount of risk when they attend to these cases. We track the deaths. My organization tracks very sad statistics related to people killed in incidents that stem from domestic violence. And essentially, every year or two in Wisconsin, another law enforcement officer dies as a result of responding to a domestic violence incident.
Patty, we hear about, you know, the choices available for victims of domestic abuse, the training for police officers dealing with it. Do we have programs out there, training out there to help prevent people from becoming domestic abusers, to prevent this happening in the first place?
Well, that is the million-dollar question. Certainly there are treatment programs for men who batter. Batter is intervention program rather than prevention. The idea is that many batterers, once arrested and whether convicted or not, may go to a court-ordered batterers intervention program. Those programs are designed to educate and teach that individual about their violent and controlling behavior and to hopefully prevent future incidents of domestic violence. But really, when we're talking about preventing violence from happening in the first place, we need to start a lot younger and a lot earlier than after the violence is already happening. We need to start working with children. Even with little kids, we can teach them core concepts of kindness and love and respect for other humans. And as kids get into middle school and certainly high school, we can be talking to them about healthy relationships and unhealthy relationships and what that looks like, and help them identify the characteristics of relationships or of behaviors that are unhealthy and abusive. We can work with kids across the age spectrum far earlier than when violence starts to happen, and start to teach them those core concepts of respect and really breaking out of our very traditionally prescribed gender roles is really a hard thing to do. But we literally teach the little boys to never cry from birth on, to never express emotion. And they end up being human beings with a lot of bottled up feelings and a lot of anger as a result of that. That doesn't necessarily mean that all little boys are going to become violent, because what's true is the number of men who are abusive is actually the small percentage of men. But we need to really think about the messages that we put out to children at an early age that is a setup for them developing abusive behaviors.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Patty Seeger from End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin.
Now, our next installment in our year-long series called State of Change, Water, Food, and the Future of Wisconsin. The melting of snow across much of Wisconsin means it's time for farmers to start spreading manure on fields to get ready for spring planting.
But it's also a risky time because some of that animal waste can run off the soil and into groundwater, streams, and lakes. Some farmers are looking for ways to reduce that runoff, but frequently people living next to the fields aren't satisfied. Chuck Kornbach reports.
In some parts of Wisconsin, growers have enrolled in government-organized demonstration projects where newer methods try to keep more soil and manure on the land. One project continuing this spring is in rural Brown County near Greenleaf. As a dog barks nearby, farmer Dan Brick reaches to the ground in a moist field and pulls up small plants.
Yeah, so this is barley. where you see the green, it's either winter wheat or winter triticale that we would have had in there.
Those species and about 10 others were planted last fall as what's known as cover crops. Manure was injected into the soil instead of being sprayed or spread more widely. The idea is maintaining vegetation on the land will reduce winter and springtime erosion. Being more careful with manure application will keep more nutrients like phosphorus on the field and out of nearby surface water where the chemical can spur unwanted plant growth like lots of algae. Brick says he looks at these acres. He gets very excited.
5 years ago, I would have thought, we got to work this field to get it to grow a crop. Realizing that we don't have to now. We can just go ahead and plant into it.
Brick says the residue of the cover crops won't get in the way of planting corn. Brick's farm, called Brickstead Dairy, is one of seven that are part of the Lower Fox Demonstration Farms Network, organized by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Coordinator Barry Bubbles says the number of acres enrolled in the five-year-old project is growing, but he acknowledges some farmers want to keep with their tradition of planting on bare ground or maybe don't have the time or money to try newer techniques.
We have more farmers to try and assist, but I'm confident that, with this demonstration farm network, that we're going to be able to continue to spread the concepts of soil health.
But in the meantime, some neighbors of farms complain about runoff getting into their drinking water wells or otherwise spoiling their property. Sandhill cranes fly over a farm in Mequon. His longtime neighbor, Ben Arnold, looks across his back fence. Even though the farm field does have a cover crop, Arnold says runoff has polluted his backyard for years.
It's as black coffee sometimes with the runoff. When the hay crop is cut off in the fall, there's nothing holding the nutrients on that land.
Arnold says manure or the weed killer atrazine have gotten into ponds, killing fish and frogs. The state of Wisconsin says it's well aware of ongoing problems with contaminated runoff. The state ag department may soon add rules that would affect the nutrient management plans farmers have to develop before spreading manure and other fertilizer. DATCAP's Sarah Walling says additional restrictions would cover when, where, and how much of the nutrients can be applied.
All of which is really intended to help increase the protections for surface water and groundwater, but while also making sure that the crops are able to receive the nutrients, the nitrogen, the phosphorus, and potassium that they need to also be productive.
Walling says the state would increase its cost sharing with farmers. But soon, a key part of the federal effort to curb runoff may be in jeopardy. President Donald Trump wants to eliminate the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, which has helped pay for the demonstration project in Brown County. Farmer Dan Brick says that would be disappointing.
We've come a long ways with this, and, we're almost to the finish line.
Once the budget battles are over, Wisconsin farmers and their neighbors will have a better idea of who's still fighting contaminated runoff. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This story is part of a year-long reporting project at WPR called State of Change, Water, Food, and the Future of Wisconsin. Find stories on Morning Edition, All Things Considered, the Ideas Network, and online at WPR.org/change.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll find out why our guest says baby monitors are changing the way we parent.
For Food Friday, we dive into the cuisine of South Asia with the author of Vibrant India.
And we'll look at a study that shows most Americans say Muslims face a lot of discrimination in America, except one group, white evangelicals. We'll find out why.
That and look at the top news stories of the day coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9, it's the Joy Cardine Show. Tomorrow after 6, it's this week's edition of Tell Joy Where to Go with a look at the best places for fish fry here in Wisconsin. A lot to choose from. That's coming up tomorrow after 6 here on the Ideas Network.
Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR. And then as Republicans scramble for congressional votes to pass their replacement health care plan, we look at what's at stake for House Speaker Paul Ryan. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.